This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
My name is Teresa Wilkie. On today's program, we discuss issues of the Kansas Corporation Commission, the KCC, with our guest, Judith Wells. But first, the environmental news for the week of 11/5. Washington Post reports the Earth's oceans have retained 60% more heat each year than previously thought, according to scientific journal Nature, suggesting an even faster rate of global warming than has been projected. The study could have important policy implications. If ocean temperatures are rising more rapidly than previously calculated, that would leave nations even less time to dramatically cut the world's emissions of carbon dioxide in the hopes of limiting global warming to the ambitious goal of 1.5 degrees Celsius, that's 3 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial levels by the end of this century. The world already has warmed 1 degree Celsius, that's 2 degrees Fahrenheit, since the late 19th century. Washington Post reports the United States Supreme Court has refused to halt a novel lawsuit filed by young Americans that attempts to force the federal government to take action on climate change, turning down a request from the Trump administration to stop it before trial. The Children's Trust lawsuit will be heard. The plaintiff children are asking the Federal Court of Appeals to find the United States government must take action to protect their right to clean air. Lawrence Journal World reports United States Equal Protection Agency Acting Administrator Andrew Wheeler visited EPA's Region 7 office in Lenexa, Kansas last week and signed a proposed new regulation that exempts livestock operations from having to report the kind of gases that are emitted from those facilities. Currently, livestock operations have to report gas emissions under the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act of 1986, a law intended to give communities greater access to information about hazardous substances. Craig Voland of Sierra Club reports emissions, particularly from large industrial-scale operation feedlots, include particulates coated with antibiotic-resistant bacteria, ammonia, and hydrogen sulfide. Following 3 years of investigation, New York is suing ExxonMobil, charging the company engaged in a long-standing fraudulent scheme to downplay the risks of climate disruption. Legal scrutiny has now resulted in a lawsuit brought by New York Attorney General Barbara Underwood, alleging that ExxonMobil deceived its investors. Several investigations have subpoenaed millions of pages of internal Exxon documents, which showed Exxon's role in covering up factual data about climate disruption for decades. Now we turn to Craig LeBeau and Judith Wells.
Thank you for joining us. This is Craig LeBeau, and my guest today is Judith Wells. And we're going to be talking about saltwater injection wells and the contamination issues and the earthquake issues from wells. And I guess it's kind of almost a pun with your last name.
Yes.
So... And you live in Mission Hills, is that correct? And you own property in Douglas County?
Correct.
Okay. And the property in Douglas County is what got you involved in this issue, is that
correct?
Right? Okay. So let's review a few things so people know what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. We're going to be talking about KCC. So tell us what that is and what they do.
Okay, the Kansas Corporation Commission is an agency within state government, and it is mandated, authorized by state government, and they actually have four different functions. One of them is oil and gas conservation. Now they have a division for that. Utilities division, which you may have seen them a lot maybe in the news if you were watching the merger of Great Plains, KCPL, with Westar. They regulated that, so that was a pretty big deal. They have a transportation division and an energy division, which I'm not sure is active right now. It's to promote energy conservation and efficiency in Kansas. So it's three commissioners appointed by the governor. And what strikes me as peculiar about these commissioners is that with all these other projects they have, especially the utilities division, because the Westar and KCPL merger was a $16 billion deal that they held off on doing, and then they allowed them to do it when they liked the way the deal was structured. And yet most of these, of the two of the three, are definitely people with oil and gas ties. And they're supposed to have no more than two people from the same political party. And try as I might, I can't tell which one of them might be a Democrat. And I assure you, I personally am a Republican, but I think we should have better representation and have, if it calls for in the statute, no more than two, then there should be no more than two Republicans on this commission.
All right. And is there any reason to believe that they have not adhered to that?
I can't. I can tell who the former legislator was, a senator, definitely was a Republican because he was the Senate Majority Leader. And Dwight Keene appears, as best I can tell, to be a Republican based on his activities and frequent appointments by the governor. And then the last person is Sherry Feist Albrecht, and she used to be with the Oil and Gas Division as that director, and has bounced around KDHE and various state agencies. I really don't know what her politics are. If they have a titular Democrat, it would be she, but it's not declared. And if they're appointing somebody who's a representative as a Democrat, it should be said in the announcement, and they did not. None of these announcements had that statement. I just think it's important.
And is there some overlap between, because I deal with energy issues,
yes,
too. Is there an overlap then between KCC and KDHE?
Not on injection wells. They have the authority. There are three types of Class II injection wells that the state has primacy for, and KDHE does one of them, which is storage of hydrocarbons, underground storage of hydrocarbons. And they are authorized by the EPA under EPA rules. And then the other two kinds of wells, injection wells, are enhanced oil recovery, which are used in oil production to water flood and increase oil production. Mm-hmm. And the other is a saltwater disposal well, and both of those are KCC, so they do not overlap on injection wells.
And so in the permitting process, mm-hmm. is which one does has it? KCC that does the permitting?
Well, there are three kinds. KCC has the two, enhanced oil recovery and saltwater disposal, alone. KDHE has underground storage of hydrocarbons, the other class two type of injection well. So they do not overlap. But what's striking to me is that KDHE did not have their own regulations in place. So when the Safe Drinking Waters Act came around in 1974, they had to come up with rules that adhered to the federal requirements in the Safe Drinking Waters Act. But in, I think it was 1986, the Waxman rule exempted all the oil and gas agencies in states that already had a permitting process for their kind of injection wells, so they do not have to adhere to Safe Drinking Water Act rules in any way, shape, or form, and they do not.
So let me make sure so everybody understands this. So
it's taken me a year to understand it, Craig.
Saltwater injection wells, they inject chemicals.
No, there are two types of saltwater injection wells.
All right.
Okay. They're not, you're thinking of fracking when you're talking about injection, and that's a producing well.
Okay,
so it's very important to understand a fracking well is one that's using a mixture of chemicals and sand and water to push oil out of the shale and increase the production. That's fracking, a totally different topic. That's production. So now injection.
Are those subject to the Safe Water Act, Drinking Water Act?
Not that I'm aware of. They are not. What I'm talking about is underground injection control wells, and that is what's covered by the Safe Drinking Waters Act. Back in the Safe Drinking Waters Act does not affect fracking, and really studies have shown. I know people would just levitate on this. Nothing has really shown that fracking per se is a problem. It's disposal of the injection fluid once it comes back out of the well and they separate it from the oil. That's the problem. What to do with all this fluid, because it takes massive amounts of flooding on a fracking well.
Okay. And are both type of wells used in fracking process, or is it only the producing wells?
Okay, fracking is only for producing.
Okay.
Okay, so it's the fracking fluid that comes back out when they put the fluids in there, the propellants, the sand, what do they call proppants? I don't know why, but it props the grains of shale open so the oil can seep to the pump and be taken out. When the pump comes up, it brings up everything, including the fluids that they don't want. So they separate the oil from these fluids. They sell the oil, goes to the refinery, and then they have the fluids left over, and they can't just dump them on the ground because they're toxic waste. They tried that apparently way back with regular wells, and it's just caused problems in Texas. This is not fluid that can be just dumped back on the ground. So the safest way would be to, in my opinion, would be to recycle the water and take the salvageable water out, and then you have a much smaller quantity of chemicals and sand to dispose of. But instead, what they've been doing is taking the whole produced wastewater, and it becomes briny from going underground. They might start with fresh water to begin with, but then what comes out is a brine solution. It's not drinking water when you get down to thousands of feet. It's whatever is leached out from minerals below the soil, just all kinds of stuff in the deep, deep water. And so what to do with that waste is the problem. And they can be disposed of safely in a saltwater disposal well, but there's more and more and more and more waste being produced, and now they're allowing saltwater disposal wells into deep rock formations in the Flint Hills, which people are concerned about. And my concern is, based on what I've looked at, is that I'm wondering if some of this water isn't going into the other kind of injection well, which is the enhanced oil recovery well, where fracking water is never supposed to go because of the volumes.
Enhanced
oil recovery.
Okay.
They like to call it an EOR in abbreviation, enhanced oil recovery. And they've been doing that for many years. When water would come back, when water brine would come up, they'd separate the usable part, because pure oil doesn't come out of the ground. Mm-hmm. It's mixed with whatever is down there. And so they separate them at the tank battery or wherever, and they sell the oil to the producer, and they take the produced wastewater and they re-inject it on its own lease into its own formation where it came from. And this is regular oil production, not a fracking well. Just a regular producing oil well. The produced wastewater is reinjected to help flush or water flood water out or oil out to the pump jacks so they can bring up and enhance the recovery of the oil.
Okay. And you said it's not fracking. So is the oil, is any of it mixed with any of the fracking, or is it completely separate?
No, these are where it's used appropriately is in a regular producing well.
Okay.
Where you use just the wastewater that came from your own lease. But if it's a fracking well, you can't put it back into the ground that you're fracking. That is wastewater that has to be disposed of somewhere else. It can't be disposed of in another formation other than it's very confusing when you try to get into all this, but it has to be produced and then injected into a deep solid rock, ideally, formation, so that it's like a big reservoir underground that's not going to mix with anything. But a producing well is in the shales, and it could mix with something else. It's a certain chemistry, a certain ecology in that layer, in that formation, and you're not ever supposed to put fracking fluids into that.
So the producing wells, if they are putting waste into that, that would be where the problem would be with the drinking water?
Yes. The drinking water issue is if they're over-injecting or there's something wrong with the well construction, or it hasn't been checked in a long time, or it wasn't checked correctly. Yes, it could affect the drinking water. But the other concern is, let me just back up a little bit and tell you how I got involved in this in Douglas County. We do own a quarter section, which is basically somebody's original homestead in Douglas County, and it's in eastern Douglas County, where they do have quite a few injection wells, as it turns out, and some producing oil wells, but they're not very high producing oil wells, very low producing oil wells. And we got a notice, because they're required for property owners within half a mile to notify adjacent landowners that they are going to do a saltwater injection. And they're applying for a permit for that. It's like, wow, I've never heard of saltwater injection wells. It sounds to me like fracking. Well, it isn't. But I did get online, I looked up saltwater injection, and I come to the EPA site. Well, they have all kinds of good information, and it makes total sense, and I'm reading the Safe Drinking Waters Act. All makes sense, and I see that these procedures aren't being followed. Many procedures that should be done that make total sense aren't being followed. So when I sent my protest, because that's what the notice calls it, a protest, to Wichita, and a copy to the applicant, which I noticed was on the application, I also sent a letter to the EPA saying, hey, I would like to have hearings as it's called for in these wonderful Safe Drinking Water Act regulations, because the KCC is not doing anything that they're supposed to be doing. And I get a letter back 6 weeks later from the EPA saying they are authorized, and they call it primacy. They are authorized by the KCC, is authorized by the EPA to unilaterally give permits for underground injection control wells, the two kinds they can, enhanced oil recovery or salt water disposal, and they don't have to follow the Safe Drinking Waters Act.
And that's because of that Waxman
Because exemption. Of the Waxman rule, the legislation, which is a beautiful thing, and the regulations, which are beautiful things, don't apply to Kansas or Missouri, I don't think, because of the carve-out. They carved out, grandfathered in the rules from the oil and gas agencies that were pre-existing, and said, okay, in order to get this moved along in committee, you can do as you were. And so they don't have to give hearings, and they don't. They don't have to require a legible signature on the application. It can be signed by another agent, and there's no paperwork saying that you've authorized that agent. When I got the application, I couldn't even read the signature. Finally realized when I was researching back and looking back, her name was Leslie Baker, and she was Drill Baby Drill. Her company is Drill Baby Drill, and she files applications for people. That's her business. But how does she get to be the authorized representative of this person in Florida who was wanting to do injection wells? I have no idea. But it's like there's just not any accountability that I could tell. And I really was disappointed to find out that the EPA cannot do anything. They can't have hearings. They can't really even tell them what to do. We're just at the mercy of whatever the KCC decides they want to do.
Are there at least some guidelines from the EPA that the KCC is required to follow?
I think the only one that they seem to take seriously is a 30 days notice. So when they put that information in the paper that an application has been filed, And if it were the Safe Drinking Waters Act, then the agency involved would get the application, and they would send out the notice to the people who had to get it, and they would make the public notice. But they don't; they leave it to the operators, and it's very iffy as to what the operators actually send out. So the 30-day rule is important because I actually accidentally brought this up because I get an applicant's application because I'm a butter. So I see the application, and the little print at the bottom, it says you have 30 days to protest. And I have a copy that's required to be sent to me of the public notice that was in the Lawrence Journal World, and it said you have 15 days to respond. It's like, huh, better get it in 15 days. So I hastily assembled about 30 hot pages and sent that off to Wichita. And question to begin with, well, I see it says 30 one place and 15 the other. I don't know which is right, but in case it's 15, here's all this. Well, that put them on notice, and I also sent a copy of that to the Lawrence Journal World. That put them on notice that it is supposed to be 30. And in fact, it was wrong, so they did republish the notice. But then someone else was looking at that and saw KCUR apparently had something on it in Lawrence, and she was looking at that, and she looked at some cases she'd been trying to follow for about the last year, and they all said 15 days notice. So then they had a hearing. The KCC had a hearing themselves, mm-hmm. an investigatory hearing, and over the prior 9 years, they'd had 2,000 wells approved with only a 15-day public notice. So that seems to be the only thing they get hot about is whether the notice is 15 days or 30. But other than that, they don't allow you any voice in the process. When you file a protest, I did not know I was going to be involved in an adversarial proceeding. I had to prove that I had the right to be there, to say anything at all. And out of over 30 people, well, probably 50 people wrote the first letter. Only 30 came back and requested the hearing, and there were only two of us who actually got to participate in the hearing, which was June.
And you got your notice just by seeing publication?
No, I got my notice because I live right next door to this
place. So they did send you
direct notice. They mailed it to me, although there was already a well on the site that I never knew about because I never got the notice for that one. They did not mail me a notice mm-hmm. on that one, and that was a prior operator.
And when you file your protest, you are filing it, then you said, in which Wichita.
Yeah, the notice.
So is that the operator?
The notice is so bad. And again, I love the Safe Drinking Waters Act, where they would have to have a notice that's formulaic. It's like you have to say where you are supposed to send it. It's like send it to the Oil and Gas Conservation Division, or just the Conservation Division, which is a real misnomer. It's like, where are they? You fumble through and find an address. I had the application, so there was an address on my application. My application also said I needed to send a copy of this protest to the applicant, so I did. But what they don't put in the public notice is where to really send it, and that you're supposed to send a copy to the applicant because you are entering an adversarial proceeding. And so they washed most people out because they didn't know that, and they didn't send it to the applicant. They said, "Well, you didn't follow our rules, so you don't get to speak at a hearing."
And one of the things I read was that Kansas is fourth in the country for the number of injection wells.
Yes.
Okay. Why is that? Why is Kansas?
Well, I'd like to know
lucky
the answer
or I'm
to
lucky
that.
To have that.
I'd like to know the answer to that. And we're 10th in oil production, so it's not like we're eliminating our own wastewater. I do think we're a net importer of wastewater. I don't think the KCC pays a whit's attention to where this water is coming from. They're very lax about even getting their injection reports. I've seen, there are over 400 wells abandoned by an operator in 2017, I found. And if they really just had their public hearing, I would have never looked at all this stuff. I would have just had my say and never started reading and looking at their website. But there were over 400 wells abandoned by an operator, mostly in Douglas County, but also like over 100 in Johnson County.
And when they abandon those, is it do you know what the reason is? Is it that they're filled and they can't use them anymore?
Well, they're supposed to be producing, but the injection rates were very, very high. And I think it's no longer economically viable. They ripped off whatever they could rip off. They grabbed whatever nickels they could grab, and then it wasn't worth their while, or they had changes in their business model, and they made enough money, and they just walk away. They leave.
Okay. And the injection wells would be limited to oil, related to oil and gas, or
yes, injection wells are related, and the ones I'm talking about are oil.
Okay,
they're enhancing oil recovery.
So you're not, none of these that you're talking about involve natural gas.
No.
All right.
No.
And are these worse, or about the same as the problems they have with the fracking from natural gas?
I can't compare those because they're not anywhere the same.
Okay,
fracking is producing.
Mm-hmm.
An injection is when you're taking produced water and using it to water flood for oil. And it's an enhanced oil recovery, EOR. It's only for oil. So it's used only for oil.
And these injection wells, is this the type of wells that we talked about that are potentially causing or contributing to earthquakes?
Yes. Yes. Okay. And you asked me a very good question. You asked me for, do we have an article? So I did look online. I found one that I'd seen before. I hadn't looked at it lately. But there's one from Scientific American that I wish, like in October of 2017, I wish, in addition to the EPA, I wish I'd found this because it's from 2012, and it talks about lax oversight, and the problem is from injection wells. It's not fracking, it's from injection wells. And then I found another one that I sent you, and it's from Newsweek more recently, February 21st of 2018, and it actually interviews some people in Kansas, and it says injections of wastewater back into the earth have been linked to a rise in earthquakes in Kansas. The news follows a similar pattern in Oklahoma and points to a disturbing consequence of extracting natural resources. So it's the consequence that's the issue. It's the wastewater that we're trying to get rid of somewhere instead of taking it to a recycling plant and reducing the amount of waste and recovering some viable water. They're injecting it. And what they've looked at, the KGS, Kansas Geological Survey, does research. They get a lot of grants. They're part of the KU campus. They're funded from the KU budget by the state legislature, but they also get grants from the Energy Department, places like that, U.S. Army Corps. And they have been looking at this. They even have a publication or two about earthquakes. But I think what they, in Kansas, but I think what they're looking at is where they expect to find fracking water injected, which would be in a salt water disposal well, where it's legally injected. But I think what is happening is, with the proliferation that we're getting, and this is surmise, but proliferation that we're getting of injection wells, particularly in Douglas County, which has very low oil production, all these injection wells that have high numbers, like 180 barrels of produced wastewater injected for each barrel of oil recovered, does not strike me as economically viable. I think they are accepting illegal fluids. I don't think that those are not fluids from their lease.
All right. We'll come back to that. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we are talking with Judith Wells about saltwater injection wells over in the Kansas side.
Tell your smart speaker, play KKFI, and enjoy the programming you love. KKFI can be wherever you are.
Thanks very much to the Sundry for sustaining our volunteers during the last fund drive. We really appreciate it when a locally owned business helps us out. They are located at the Westport Commons at the corner of Warwick and 39th Street right here in Midtown. The Sundry's choice to sustain our volunteers is one of the truest forms of community support. Thank you.
I am Linda Wilson, host of Woman Song on Saturdays at 11 a.m. As a retired federal employee, I ask all my federal employee friends to support KKFI through the combined federal campaign. A few dollars each payday through payroll deductions could hardly be missed by you, but they add up to being a big help for KKFI Community Radio. The CFC agency code is 21994. That's 21994. Thanks for your support.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. After Hurricane Maria, Javier Camacho wanted to help his fellow Puerto Ricans who were struggling in homes with no electricity.
I kept seeing people suffering. And as a Christian, I was, God, I need to help my people. I need to find a way to help.
As a self-taught software developer, Camacho loves to tinker with technology. So with the aid of tutorials on YouTube, he figured out how to give discarded laptop batteries a new life. By connecting old battery cells together, he was able to build battery packs that can store energy from solar panels.
My desperation pushed me through so much information in the internet that in less than a month, I was already starting to make batteries on my home using recycled materials.
Since then, Camacho has made solar generators with backup battery storage for dozens of island residents. Most of the materials, including the panels, are donated. He's also launched a series of YouTube videos to teach others how to make them. His goal is to help people be more prepared when disasters strike.
When you teach them, you are actually giving them power. Now they can say, I don't have to wait for someone to help me. I could do it.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And a special KKFI programming note, we will be covering the election, as only you would hear on community radio, from 6 to midnight tomorrow night with a mixture of national coverage from Pacifica, based out of the East Coast, and, of course, input from a lot of your own KKFI news and public affairs people. Now I'll turn it back over to Craig and his guest, Judith.
Okay, thank you, Mike. And we are here still with Judith Wells, and we are talking about saltwater injection wells and state of Kansas and problems with that. We are going to go ahead and open up the phone line to take some phone calls. So if you have any comments or questions, call us at 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534. All right. Let me ask you, I don't know if we mentioned it before, but when you got involved, this was last year.
Correct.
In
when
2017.
I started, yes.
Okay. Now, the problems, of course, have been going on much longer than
yes.
that.
Yes.
And is there any litigation by any parties relating to any of these issues that is going on right now?
That's an interesting question. We need to define litigation because they seem to think when you're actually any innocent person responding to a public notice or an application who files a protest apparently does enter litigation at an agency level with the KCC mm-hmm. because I do think they're bound and determined to give the permit, and anybody who says otherwise is put in an adversarial position and is dismissed right and left by litigation counsel, which is startling to me that their job is to get rid of public input. So if you were talking about that, yes, that is ongoing. I know people who throughout the state have filed protests, and I've filed myself a protest on a well in Reno County. Now that I've read the application and studied the area, I'm very concerned about that. So if that's what you mean by litigation, yes, those things are ongoing.
All right. As far as you know, that nobody has like maybe filed suit against KCC to force them to comply with any of the
that is another topic, and that is there's a category that's allowed by statutes in the Administrative Act, which mm-hmm. I did not bring with me. I brought some statutes and things with me. And I like the statutes better than I like their regulations. because they write them themselves with an advisory committee that is all oil and gas people. But the judicial review is what a person can request when they disagree with the proceedings, the actual operations, not just a decision, but the way it was done. And I know a man, I've met him in person twice now. His name is Scott Juergen, and he has filed in Shawnee County for in district court for judicial review of a decision. He filed as a protest on a well, and he's from Franklin County. So I'm going to guess his well that he was filing was Franklin County. And he was dismissed from even having a hearing because they say, well, you have to prove that you are directly affected, that you were directly harmed. Before a well is even started operation, you have to prove that you've been harmed, which is kind of backwards to me. So I know he has filed. And I have also filed in Douglas County for judicial review of what happened after the hearing that I was involved in next to me. It was the Thrasher lease. And that sticks in my craw because there was a well there, an injection well that I mentioned earlier I did not know about because I never got a written notice for it. And there was an injection well that had been abandoned by somebody who drilled it in 2013, and by 2015 he was gone. He abandoned it that fast. And he went back to Texas, and the lease still operated. And apparently the operator who ended up operating it bought the lease from him, because that's public record in the Douglas County Courthouse, and owned it for 15 months before going in to declare themselves an operator and get an operator's permit, which is not supposed to ever happen. And when it was abandoned, they did revoke that injection well permit. And when this guy showed back up, the injection control director just gave it back to him, even though that's against what the statutes say. And they decided, oh, that'll be fine. And I think, I don't think that will be fine. That's not the way. It'd be like if you revoked my driver's license in Topeka and I went into my local driver's license office and said, you know, I'd really like my driver's license back, and it would be a huge inconvenience for me to have to go through all this other stuff. Would you just give it back to me? And they just gave it back to me. You're just not supposed to do that. I'm just asking that they follow the statutes.
Okay. And when you say they gave it back to him, they approved the permit?
He just reinstated it. It had been revoked when he went back in, and I got this information. It's linked on the website of their wells, and it says in handwritten notes in red ink, per legal, need new application. This was revoked June 9th, 2016. Mm-hmm. And it operated continuously on a revoked permit. These are all supposed to be huge things that aren't supposed to happen, and they were.
And that was, so he went to Texas, and then they came back to Kansas to do this.
This is a different Magnum Exploration Kansas was a guy out of Texas. Uh-huh. He blew into town, ran up some bills, owed the county money, didn't pay those taxes, drilled some wells, sold the lease, but sold it to somebody he'd had business dealings before, and was partners with him on some other leases, but not that particular lease, and sold it to him. So the person who came in to take the rest of it, who bought it from him, was from Florida. A person from Florida.
Okay. And at one point, I think you said that a lot of them are being abandoned because they're not economical.
I'm guessing that's why.
Okay.
I don't know. They just abandon them, and instead of plugging wells that they should when they're old wells or it's low production, if you're the operator, you're supposed to plug them. That's your job. That's what you take on for. And they just leave. And I have noticed, I figured out how to just look at their penalty orders, what little code to put in, and look at the KCC penalty orders. And time and again, they, like this one that abandoned 243 wells in Douglas County, they just sent him one letter saying, here, you've abandoned 411 wells or whatever it is, and lists them all, which is handy for me to look them up, and says if you don't reply in 60 days, we will revoke the permits on the injection wells. He didn't reply in 60 days, and so they just closed it.
And when these wells are abandoned, is there an agency monitoring the drinking water?
No.
At all?
No. No, they should be. I agree, and that is a concern, because reading the regulations and the statutes, mm-hmm. and the statutes refer to the operator, and the operator is very important. If the operator's not there, and the statute calls the care and control of the operator, if the operator is not doing regular checkups, and there's not care and control, and there's nobody filing some kind of pitiful little financial bond that they sort of sometimes collect to cover any damages caused, we're just bare naked. There's nothing, and nobody is looking at these things. And I have most of them I cannot see were the Butler Petroleum ones that were abandoned in 2017. But the ones that I can see from the road, I can smell the oil. Mm-hmm. I can smell it, and it's right by creeks. They don't have enough, they call it freeboard. You're supposed to have a great big dish where oil might leak down into. And there's a lot of water in Douglas County. It all goes into the Wakarusa. Everything in my area of Douglas County goes into the Wakarusa.
A few years ago, there were a couple of movies that were produced showing people drawing their water from well water, mm-hmm. and it was when you flammable, and it would start fire.
Right.
Is that related to these type of saltwater injection wells?
No, should not be if it's just salt water that's being injected in there. Salt water doesn't burn.
Okay.
But if they're injecting other chemicals and it does manage to leak into the drinking water, yes, who knows what could happen. We do have a water well on our property that we drilled new in 1996, and I have not had it tested lately, but we use it for washing and not for drinking. Mm-hmm. I just haven't had it tested, but I just don't know what's going on with the water wells.
And so there's no monitoring by any agency to determine if they're putting other chemicals in with the salt water.
No,
illegally.
There's not. And they seem remarkably uninterested.
Okay.
Because that's what I was trying to bring up in the hearing in June. It's like, I'm looking at these nearby leases, and you say I should be reassured because there are 79 injection wells near me, and I'm totally not reassured because I look at their injection numbers and their production numbers, and I compare the two, and there's massively more injection of wastewater. It's not coming from that lease. Where mm-hmm. is it coming from? And when I asked that question in the hearing, Renee Stuckey said, well, that would require engineer's reports. We'd have to spend some money and study that. It would slow everybody down. That is what he said. Has no mm-hmm. interest. Doesn't think it's even his job. I don't know whose job it would be.
And that's one of the KCC commissioners? Or?
No. There's a little KCC, and if you manage to get to a hearing, you'll actually see those three commissioners, maybe. Mm-hmm. But the nuts and bolts happens out of Wichita. And that's called the Oil and Gas Conservation Division. They like to call themselves the Conservation Division, but it's the Oil and Gas Conservation Division. Their mission is to get oil out of the ground, not to waste water and to waste oil, and not to intrude on anybody else's oil rights. That's their main mission. So it is the oil and gas people who are just very... They're facing the operators who come in and say, well, I want my permit. Well, they're not going to stand up to them, and they don't. They just give them a permit.
All right. And I want to give out our phone number again. We are taking calls. If you have any questions or comments, you can call us at 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534. Right. So let's move a little bit into what you see might be some solutions to remedy these problems.
Yes, I think this regulations, well, big picture would be to have commissioners that are appointed that aren't just oil and gas insiders. That would be a big thing. That's the three commissioners. But the other thing is the legislature needs to wake up a little bit. I know they have a lot of things that they're concerned about, but they have one bright and shining sentence in there that says the KCC can write their own regulations. This is in the Kansas Statutes 55, Chapter 55, Oil and Gas. 152A is the exact. You can find that online. It just says that the state authorizes the KCC to write regulations to protect the usable waters of the state from actual or potential pollution from any well. That's a nice, broad statement. But they do not interpret it that way. They want people to have to prove they've been directly damaged by a well that hasn't even happened yet. They haven't even approved yet. And then the other thing they could do was be add on to that. Give us some specifics. Give the public a right to have hearings. They need to hear from the public. They need to hear people's concerns. And they do everything so that they don't have to listen to the public. And that would also be useful. And then the other, another thing would be their advisory commission, mm-hmm. which is 12 people. One of them is supposed to be appointed by the governor from the public. I don't know who that is, if that person has been appointed. But the other 12 are oil and gas lobby this and oil and gas lobby that, or they pick somebody from, they pick the other person. It's all incestuous, and it's headed by the person who's the director of the oil and gas, of the oil and gas conservation division. We need to have a little more public input. Yeah.
And you've mentioned before that under the Waxman rule, Kansas was granted an exemption. How many states have that exemption?
That's a very good question. Missouri does, because I looked it up.
Okay.
Other states that I've looked on online, they don't. It's like, wow, they have hearings. They actually give people a chance to speak. They actually don't play tricks on them to keep them from getting to speak. It's not an adversarial position. I don't know. I think it's quite a few.
All right.
I think Texas is one of them. It's their railroad commission actually issues those, if you can imagine that, and it's not a good thing.
Okay. And so we only have about a minute and a half left, between a minute and a half and two. So if you can just, if there's a couple thoughts that you want to close with.
I just would like the legislation to make a difference. The regulations that the KCC writes for themselves with the oil and gas division input are all oil and gas. There are too many options. There's too little enforcement. They have this person, Butler Petroleum, abandoning over 400 wells in Kansas, and all they do is write him one letter, and he doesn't respond, and they drop it. That's a huge tax burden on the taxpayer to take care of all these things, and it could cause environmental damage.
All right. I want to thank you for being here. For those just joining us, we've been talking to Judith Wells about saltwater injection wells. And also just want to add a brief comment Mike mentioned before and told you about the election coverage we'll have tomorrow. I'm actually going to be in the field. I'll be covering it for the station, calling in from the campaign watch party for Shreets Davids. And if possible, Spencer hopes to be at Laura Kelly's. Thank you for joining us.
Now the calendar of events for the week of 11-5. On 11-6, 9 a.m. to noon, in Kansas City, Missouri, City Hall, Park Hill School District's permit application is number 1 on the Kansas City, Missouri Planning Commission docket. Consequently, expect the City Planning Commission to begin discussion soon after the meeting starts at 9 a.m. Save the Last Kansas City Forest invites people to be present in favor of a permanent conservation pledge by the Park Hill School District special use permit, which would save the Lion Creek Forest. Also on November 6th, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., Heartland Sierra Club meets at All Souls Unitarian Church, 4501 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. The program is Sustainable Food, the Environmental Impact of Eating. Discover what you put in your mouth today determines what the environment will be tomorrow. November 7th, 7 p.m. at Lawrence Public Library, 707 Vermont, Dr. Jesse Neipert, grassland ecologist and principal investigator of the Kansas Prairie Long-Term Ecological Research Program, will speak on climate change's impact on the tall grass prairie. Ken Lassman will join to share information about global trends. This is co-sponsored by Grassland Heritage Foundation, KU Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, and the Lawrence Public Library. RSVP and questions to grasslandheritage@gmail.com. There are a few events at Bridging the Gap this week. November 7th, 9 a.m. to noon, volunteer to plant small trees at Leah McKeegan Park in Lee Summit, Missouri. 11:10, 9 a.m. to noon, volunteer to plant street trees in the Woodneath neighborhood near I-35 and 152 Highway in the Northland. No prior tree planting experience is necessary. Tools and equipment will be provided. Minimum age 14 with adult supervision. Ages 14 to 16 must be accompanied by an adult volunteering alongside them. Go to bridgingthegap.org to sign up. On November 8th, 6:30 p.m. to 8 p.m., a Conservation Families Survival Skill Workshop will be held at Burr Oak Woods. It's a free event, 1401 Northwest Park Road, Blue Springs, Missouri. Participants will learn the basics of finding food, water, and shelter, and try some of these skills. Class is held outside and is open to families with children ages 6 and older. Registration is required at www.mdc.mo.gov/Burr Oak Woods. On November 10th, 9 a.m. to noon, volunteer with Kansas City Wildlands to remove shrub honeysuckle at Hidden Valley Park, north of the river, 6400 Northeast Russell Road, Kansas City, Missouri. If you have questions or a group, contact Linda Lehrbaum at 816-561-1089 or email Linda at bridgingthegap.org. There's an open meeting on November the 12th, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m., for people interested to volunteer to plan the 10th annual Kaw Valley Seed Fair, no experience necessary. Lawrence Public Library in Meeting Room B, 707 Vermont, Lawrence, Kansas. These items and more can be viewed on the Facebook page and at the kkfi.org Eco Radio KC program page.
A chemical used in weapons is showing up in water samples. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
The tragic mudslides in Southern California last week have killed 18, with 5 people still missing. More than 60 homes were destroyed and more than 400 damaged.
According to the National Weather Service, over 6 inches of rain fell near Montecito, where the disaster struck.
Mudslides like the one that occurred last week are not new. A fact sheet by the USGS says that flooding and debris flows are common in the aftermath of wildfires, such as the Thomas Fire, that recently devastated the area and was only contained last week after burning for a month.
KPCC reports there's been a long history of mudslides in Southern California, with one of the worst occurring in 1969 that killed 87.
The recent wildfires and mudslides were on the minds of two members of the Los Angeles City Council who last week urged the city to file suit against oil companies for damages they see as linked to climate change.
Their call follows a lawsuit filed last week by New York City against five major oil companies. The city claims the companies have known for years that burning fossil fuels causes global warming, but hid that knowledge, and that together the five companies produced 11% of all global warming gases through the products they sold.
The suit seeks to shift the costs of protecting the city onto the companies that have created the conditions leading to climate change.
In response to New York's action, a spokesman for Chevron told the Washington Post that the suit will do nothing to address the serious issue of climate change. And a spokesperson for ExxonMobil added that the lawsuits filed by trial attorneys do not reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
New York City is also planning to divest its pension funds from fossil fuels. About $5 billion will be invested in other industries as long as pension fund trustees agree.
A chemical which is used to make military explosives is showing up in water and soil samples.
According to recent reporting by ProPublica, the substance known as RDX that was developed by the U.S. during the Second World War and is still used today is being carried by winds during weapons testing and settling in soils.
From there, it easily moves into water supplies. Surface and groundwater samples show that RDX persists and does not quickly dissolve or break down.
Recently, Canadian researchers looked at soil and water samples and found that in nearly 75% of them, RDX made its way into aquifers, exceeding safe levels.
RDX has been classified as a possible carcinogen by the EPA. The agency suggested that it has a danger score stricter than other deadly pollutants such as benzene and atrazine.
The RDX contamination is not confined to the U.S. and is, according to the researchers, an internationally known issue. ProPublica states that one of the EPA's foremost experts on pollution from explosives has said that RDX is the single greatest problem the U.S. faces when it comes to cleaning up thousands of toxic munitions sites.
But the Pentagon says that RDX does not pose a great risk and has fought against the EPA classifying it as a likely carcinogen.
Large quantities of water ice have been discovered on Mars by a powerful camera on board NASA's reconnaissance orbiter.
The ice formations were seen in areas where erosion has removed rocks and surface dirt, exposing steep cross-sections of frozen water that range from 1 to 100 meters in depth.
The journal Wired reports that it's not just the volume of water found, it's how mineable it promises to be to support things like drinking, growing crops, or making hydrogen for fuel.
The water ice was found further north than where the current Mars landing missions can go because of extremely low temperatures. Scientists theorize that one might have to drill deeper in areas closer to the Martian equator to find the ice.
Two missions to the Red Planet are planned in 2020, one by NASA and the other by the European Space Agency, both of which will be capable of studying the ice in more detail. The discovery was reported in last week's issue of Science by researchers led by the USGS.
And finally, last week, British Prime Minister Theresa May unveiled a new green agenda for the UK in which she pledged to eliminate the scourge of plastics. Speaking at a nature reserve just south of London, she outlined a plan to eradicate avoidable plastic waste within 25 years.
That plan includes things like calling on supermarkets to create plastic-free aisles when displaying food, and imposing a levy on all single-use plastics from coffee cups to spoons and forks. She also wants to extend a charge on plastic bags to all retailers, including corner shops, in an effort to take millions of sacks out of circulation.
While environmental groups applauded her efforts for raising awareness about plastics and other issues, they complained that the plan lacked specifics and didn't go far enough. Opposition politicians said the announcement was just a cynical ploy to attract young eco-conscious voters to her Conservative Party. Recent polling found that climate change was the top policy issue for Britons aged 18 to 28.
But there might be another reason for the sudden interest in going green: China. Last year, the country announced it would no longer be the world's garbage dump, recycling about half of the globe's plastics and paper. A ban on that recycling went into effect on January 1st.
According to Greenpeace, every year, Britain sent enough recyclables to China to fill 10,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools. The United States ships so many millions of tons of scrap paper and plastic annually to China, it's the sixth largest export to the country.
While China's move has left Western countries scrambling to deal with their waste, most environmental groups say the answer is clear. Find sustainable alternatives to plastics.
To that end, they might take a lead from the Lonely Whale Foundation, which began its Strawless in Seattle campaign last September. The group seeks to raise awareness about plastic pollution in the oceans and the impact our lifestyles have on the environment, such as using plastic straws.
In other words, protect the planet and don't suck.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, bringing together the best and brightest minds in the water sector at ACE 18. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE18.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
You're listening to 90.1 FM.